Welcome to the Law Firm Growth Lab, the science of scaling your practice. 3, 2, 1,
action.
So hello, this is Scott Berry, and I am a fractional CMO and an agency owner that works with family immigration law firms and family law firms. And so recently, I ran into some work that Ruby Powers was doing for the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, and also just recently the Texas State Bar Advanced Family Law Conference, where she was talking in both instances about the intersection between immigration law and family law. And immediately when I saw that, since those are the two practice areas that I work with as a CMO and as my agency works with marketing services, I said, this, our followers, the people that we talk to, like, they need to see this. This is meant for them. So I'm super excited that Ruby, who's very busy speaking with both groups and heavily involved in AILA and all the state bars and has her own practice. Ruby Powers is a board certified immigration attorney, and we're thrilled to have her here. So Ruby, thank you for sharing this information. I know it was well received in these other two. That's basically two pretty significant events in the last 2 or 3 weeks. This message is hot.
Thanks so much. Yeah, I actually had fun putting the material together because I was like, wow, there's so much overlap. And as a practicing immigration attorney for, I guess, 17 years, there's always those places where I need to know a little bit enough about family law, and I need to have a team up and have a good referral source as well for in that space. But there's been so many changes recently, so I felt like it was almost like a service I needed to do to just get this out there and have some of my message out there in terms of like how to screen, when to really, probably the other big message is to have a couple of immigration attorneys that you could have maybe on speed dial or to refer business to as needed, just because of all the changes that are going on and over that intersection with family law. But I appreciate Scott thanks for having me. So immigration issues every family lawyer should know. We know that immigration is federal, and we know family is state, but there's a lot of similarities around the country. In immigration, just to give you a little perspective, it's made up of a lot of case law, regulations, policies, interpretations, and sort of how people feel that day, unfortunately. So we have the different departments, Department of Homeland Security, which was created in 2003. We have the Department of State, Department of Justice, and Department of Labor are the big ones that immigration has to interact with. So let's go ahead and dive in. As he mentioned, I'm a board-certified immigration attorney. I have my practice, Powers Law Group. It's in Houston, Texas. I guess my big areas are being in immigration for a while. Even before I became an attorney, I worked at the International Student Office at University of Texas in the year of 2001. But I also worked for the Committee on Homeland Security right after the creation of DHS. So it was a fascinating times. And being board certified, I seem to get a lot of complicated cases, but my firm is full service. And so we can help everything from employment and investment, humanitarian, immigration court, asylum, complex citizenship cases, consular processing, waivers, all that good stuff. And then I also do a lot of work with law practice management with a book and a podcast called Power Up Your Practice. But more about immigration and family. So this intersection is, there's a lot of intersection. The crazy thing is like, I really do pull a lot from what I studied in law school and preparing for the bar, but you'd be surprised. Also, I have to know a lot about international matters as well because of whether or not a marriage was valid in that country. Is it valid for immigration purposes? So there's a lot of overlap anywhere from divorce, custody, protective orders. This also can affect whether a person's eligible for visas. So we have to know enough. There's times when people were married to two people at the same time, or they thought they were married to this person, but they really were married to that person. And how does that affect your immigration? Usually whenever I hear someone say annulment in an immigration context, I'm like, no, that's not good, but it depends on the situation. So I sort of learned the things that I need to know. And immigration relief could be jeopardized without understanding the implications. So I think one of my biggest takeaways, if you listen to anything, is to make sure you have teamed up with an experienced immigration attorney if you practice primarily family, because there's just so many changes happening. And even my firm, we are full service, but some firms only have subsections within immigration, like maybe just family and removal or humanitarian, or maybe family and employment-based, investment-based immigration, because there's just so much within immigration as well. It's a large scope. Even one thing I don't do is adoption meets immigration. I just decide not to do that. There's so much, and I'm like, you know what? I do most of it, but that's one thing I'm not going to do because I've seen it messed up, and I don't want to be the reason why a kid gets their status. I usually am the person who helps clean up messes where people make mistakes on that. Okay, so there's intersections. So this is probably some of the things I would say are really important that maybe a family lawyer would need to screen for, being able, or at least just being aware. So a client's immigration status. Well, you would think like that's pretty simple, right? You either show me a US citizen, a birth certificate, which, depending on how things go with the birthright citizenship executive order, it could be that one day a US birth certificate does not convey US citizenship. And honestly, that's pretty mind-blowing to me. But, you know, what is the status? Is it temporary protected status? Is it asylum pending? Is it a parole? Is it special immigrant juvenile? So usually it's been that if they're under 18, I don't like the word assuming, but you're like, oh, they're probably an American kid, a citizen. But no, there's been a lot of influx of individuals over the last handful of years, and it could be that they were sort of status insecure, I guess you could say, and then were in transition. The other thing I like to look for, and maybe this is a bit much for a family lawyer, but this is what I look for, is past immigration filings. Or immigration removal orders, deportation orders. When I like to see what was filed before because I want to see what USCIS potentially has on file or Department of State and if there's any inconsistencies because consistency equals truth. And if there's any inconsistency somewhere that could cause problems for misrepresentation or fraud, there's a lot of DACA. DACA came out, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, under Obama in the summer of 2012. It's a precarious status, but it has still remained continued. But since 2017, we haven't had brand new DACA. So many of the people who have didn't qualify beforehand were not eligible to apply after all the litigation going up to the Supreme Court and back down again. But there are many, I think it's less than a million now DACA recipients, and many of them, the oldest DACA recipient is 44. So they're not kids anymore, and a lot of them are married to citizens, have citizen kids, and out there. Temporary protected status is not so temporary, it's appeared to be longer, but in many cases, it's being discontinued under this administration. And there have a lot of people have pending asylum cases. Just it can be very complex in terms of I like a story I have right now is a mom petitioned for two minor children, but that mom got married to an American and got her green card. And now her kids are going to get cut off on their mom's asylum claim if they don't create their own asylum claim. And so just that virtue, the act of marriage can cause be a huge detriment to the children. And that's usually who I'm looking out for the most in situations like this, because the children aren't normally the ones in my office. They're not the one, no, it's usually the parents and they're the decision makers. They're the ones who have the money, but I'm trying to look out for the kids and be like, you know, this is going to affect your kid's case, or you know that kid's going to turn 21 before you know it, or make sure that if you let me know before that child gets married or turns 21 or something like that. Criminal history, one thing that's a big confusion to most people is if a person admits the elements of a crime, it still could be a conviction for immigration purposes. So let that sink in. So even if it gets dismissed, it still could be a conviction. So when people tell me, oh, it was dismissed, I say, no, show me the paper. I want to read it. I need to double check. Why was it dismissed? And then we can go from there. So also a misdemeanor state could be a felony on an immigration matter. So you really have to check those things. And then we're also evaluating law in other countries compared to the United States as well. eligibility of petitions and other forms of relief. That really depends on who's married to whom, when, where, how, what country they're from. And so that gets a little more complicated, but these are just some of the things that we look for. You might want to have a screening checklist of things that that could be an issue, and then tell them to go to an immigration attorney, depending, or maybe just say, have you talked to an immigration attorney? I think you should, because if you're trying to remain here and retain custody or have not be taken advantage of because of a precarious status, you having that knowledge is power. So again, having a trustworthy immigration attorney. There are some who have a lot of experience and the location is not as necessary, but if you want to, maybe you could find someone closer to where you practice or where the majority of your clients are. But even though we are federally practicing, one other website that I like to things I like to mention, maybe you didn't know, is that we always do a lot of FOIAs, Freedom Information Act requests, and this is what really helps us get to know what happened in the past. I usually say I can't tell you how to suggest the solution for the future until I know what happened in the past. And most of the people don't know what happened in the past and they didn't keep a copy of their application. But there's lots of places that we could FOIA from USCIS, which again was only created after DHS was Department of Homeland Security was created in 2003. So depending on what year we're talking, we might have to go to a different agency. CBP, OBIM is one that you can send fingerprints and a date of birth, and that one can sometimes give more information because sometimes people only gave a date of birth and a name, and they might have given a wrong name and they might have given a wrong date of birth, and the old databases might not be able to get you what you really need. Department of State, there's other places, just probably like you're familiar with the FOIAs, but and FBI background checks, because sometimes people say, oh, I don't know where that happened. Sometimes we have to start with the FBI background check and then start finding out where to go collect criminal records. The Executive Office of Immigration Review is housed under Department of Justice, and this is who oversees immigration court. And on this website, if you have the A number of the individual, which is immigrants who have somehow been in the system somehow through immigration, have an A number, they should have an A number, and you can put it in here and see if they are in immigration court or had an immigration court matter that's active. Or was finalized with potentially a termination or dismissal or a deportation order or an approval too. So again, it's a really fast way as long as you have a number to get some information. Okay, this is sort of like a good overview of what I want to walk through, and we'll have a slide for pretty much every point here. And the marriage vase, the marriage and divorce from adjustment of status. To the special immigrant juvenile. This is for abused, abandoned, or neglected minors. This became pretty more well known and used after around 2014, approximately, and has a two-step process where we work with the family law side and then the immigration side. Violence Against Women Act, which is a misnomer because it's not just the violence against women, it's for all gender, and it can be a self-petition. And then there's a U visa, which is a victim of a crime. This comes into play with family where it's a domestic violence issue. And so, usually, what happens is if the victim of violence is because of a U.S. citizen spouse, for example, then we would go with VAWA. But if it's because the spouse was, or the not, they weren't married, but didn't have a status, for example, we would go with the U visa. There's also sometimes where we would go to U visa instead of VAWA due to if there's too many entries and exits and the person's permanently barred. But anyway, it's still a family law component. The T visa is victim of trafficking, and this is for labor or sexual matters. There also could be trafficked by your own family. So that's why I wanted to bring that up here too. The U visa has about a 15-year wait right now if you file today. And the T visa has like around a 2-year wait. Temporary protective status, like I said, it was thought to be, it says temporary, but there's some countries that have had it here in the country, in the US, like Honduras, El Salvador, they've had it for almost like 20 plus years. And so you start getting a little comfy with it and you're think, oh, I have it for a while. But this last year, the administration's been trying to discontinue most of them. And so you really just go to the USCIS website under TPS and they'll give you a good idea of which ones are continued for how long and what's the future status of that. citizenship issues. Oh my goodness. I had a really good consult this week. Basically, it's possible for a person to be a US citizen and not even know it. The individual this week was his dad became a citizen before he was born, and I calculated it was 5 years before the child was born. And I think if he can go find that his dad was, the parents were not married, so I have to know parental status. I have to know, was the dad on the birth certificate? Did he ever acknowledge the paternal, I forgot what the word was, but paternal,
Rights.
yeah, to the child
Yes.
before the age of 18. And so anyway, he's off to go find some research, but that child, that kid, he's not a kid anymore, but like I really hope, fingers crossed, we can find that dad was in the US 5 years, because it's quite fascinating. Actually, the guy has a deportation order.
Wow.
And I'm like, if you can go find out you're a US citizen, then all your troubles will go away. But I don't want to get too excited. But I found about maybe three to six citizens in my lifetime. It's sort of like sifting for gold, that didn't know about it already. And then an immig so citizenship can be complex. There's midwife birth issues, which is a big issue we have in Texas. But it is possible to be a citizen even though you were born abroad, to one or two American parents, depending on the year you were born, whether they were married or not, and how much time they spent in the United States. It's quite fascinating and complex. And then immigration court, depending on how you were in immigration court, maybe you got in there somehow, and then now you marry a US citizen. And so the marital status can have impact, adjustment of status, cancellation removal for qualifying relatives. So this really has a big part factor. And if you can include other family members on your asylum claim based on a legal marriage at the time of the adjudication. And then right now there's another concern about a lot of detention and protective orders and rapid deportation. At this time of recording, we are seeing up to 60,000 people in immigration detention right now, which is, I believe, it's off the charts. I don't think they've ever seen that ever before, which causes a lot of complications and, of course, is in my personal opinion, a human rights issue. But it is a concern for a lot of people of what their status is and how it can impact them. Okay, so let's start going in a deep dive into each one a little bit. So, divorce and immigration impacts. If an individual gets their legal permanent residency, or I'll just say green card, based off of marriage, I don't know if anybody's watched the movie Green Card by Gerard Depardieu, or The Proposal with Sandra Bullock. Almost all those things are, those are fun to watch. I mean, I think there's even the 90 Day Fiancé and stuff like
Yeah.
that. So they're, yeah, they're fun to watch, but you know, as an immigration attorney, I sort of cringe, because it's like, it's, you know, they're not reflecting what really always happens. But the concept was, is that there was a lot of marriage fraud, I think maybe back in a long time ago. And so they were trying to prevent it. So they thought 2 years is sort of like how long a real marriage, like how long they could probably hang in there. I don't know. And so after, if you get your green card based off of marriage and you've been married less than 2 years at the time they're approving you, then you'll get a conditional green card. And if and then you have to remove the condition within 2 years, or else you'll lose your green card. Now, if the couple didn't last that full amount of time to remove the condition together, there is a way to do it with what they call a waiver. But you either have to show that it was a good faith marriage, or maybe there was abuse or some extreme hardship or some other issue that happened. But anyway, this is really one big place where the marriage comes into play. And so a lot of times people come to me and they say, it's not working out. We're probably gonna have to get divorced. And then they're very concerned because their status here in the country is tied to their marital status. And you know, it's like the worst things of both areas of law colliding. And a lot of the times when I'm talking to them, like I can just tell that they're having such a hard time moving on with their life with another relationship, or just deciding what to do, because they just don't know what they're gonna get to stay in the country. But it's also so tied to their, you know, their healing. I usually tell them to go get therapy and do those types of things, because I can see the pain and everything that they've been going through. But anyway, this can also impact children's statuses as well as derivatives. And so those are the questions that I think people need to be asking, is like, what will this mean? And this is where I was talking about annulment, because my interpretation of what I understand annulment is as if the marriage didn't happen. So if that were to be the case, in this immigration context, then that means the person shouldn't have gotten the green card. And then the whole status didn't exist. But there are ways for people to still maintain their green card status, even if they don't stay married. And so that's another thing I want people to know. You know, it's just have a consultation, tell them to have consultation. But I don't want people to think they need to stay in relationships that are abusive or not healthy just because they think that's the only way they can maintain their immigration status. Under public charge, so public charge is something that USCIS likes to talk about, usually when Trump's president, every once in a while. But anyway, if you look at USCIS public charge, it'll tell you when this is a concern. But usually what the gist of it is that when somebody wants to petition for, let's say, a U.S. citizen parent or, I mean, sorry, a U.S. citizen spouse or they're a citizen, they want to petition for their parent, they need to fill out this I-864. So when you're a familial application and you want to pass on a green card, you have to fill out this form. It's a contract. This is one of the things that we talked about at the State Bar Conference, and my board certified family colleague on the panel told a lot of detail about this. And he said that this is actually challenged, this contract, and that divorce doesn't absolve a person from being required to support the individual per this contract. Honestly, as an immigration attorney, I just tell them what they need to do to meet the qualifications of the I-864. And you look at the I-864P, and I've done this a long time. You know, I need some pay stubs, some taxes, an employment letter. But the impact is that the person is on the hook for the I-864 until the individual either becomes a citizen, passes away, abandons their green card, or has 40 credits with Social Security. But it is important to note that it can be enforced even beyond a divorce. But I haven't seen that as an immigration attorney because that's not really in my wheelhouse. But this is something that you should know about. And so here are the four ways in which the individual is still on the hook for this or still obligated. So keep this in mind. And if you have a family member, if you have a client that is completing the I-864 for any reason, or keep this in mind if they might have filed one in the past. So here we go to inter-country adoption and immigration. The gist of it is that there's the Hague countries, and then there's the orphan process, which is the non-Hague countries. The bottom line is if you want to adopt a child through, you need to know which country they're from and which process do you go, and then that's where it's going to guide you which process you need to follow. But the big thing that I want to say in this bottom bullet here is that the state court approval, you may do the family adoption, but it does not automatically grant immigration benefits. It really depends on which process you're going through, Hague or non-Hague. What country and when did you meet the requirements on time? For example, with Hague, if you don't have the family study, family living coinciding together for those 2 years before the age of 16, I believe is what those details are, then you cannot confer an immigration benefit. And so this is why a lot of times when people come to me like, can I adopt my adult child, or can I adopt or this adult family member to be my grown child, or can I do this? I was like, well, you can do pretty well, probably whatever you want. I mean, I'm not a family law attorney, but for the immigration side, like if that's what you're asking me because you're coming to an immigration attorney, well, like let's talk about this, and probably it's not going to work because you're coming too late. So that's the one thing I want to say. And so I usually just refer to an immigration attorney in Pennsylvania that does this, and this is her thing. So, but this is important to note where family law and immigration and adoption can meet, but it's very strict and convoluted, and it has to be done just right. So let's move over to other complex fun citizenship cases. I really like this because my mom was a citizen, and she didn't know it. It's really quite a fascinating story. And so there's lots of different provisions. This is one that was made to help protect children. I think it came out around 2001, but the INA 320. So this was because what was happening was parents were getting green cards and then they were forgetting about the kids. And I mean, they love the kids, but they were still forgetting about the process and they were under a lot of like assumptions about stuff. And honestly, assume is like such a dangerous word. Like I don't even like let it be in my vocabulary. But and if you use it in immigration law, you're making a mistake because it's usually probably the opposite of whatever you would assume. But anyway, it is possible that a child could have become a citizen but not have proof of it, just like I was sharing another story. But that story I was telling is under a different provision. So there's jus solis and jus sanguinis. So jus solis is of the soil, so solis. And jus sanguinis is of the blood. And so there's different provisions in the INA that would confer the citizenship. But here's one that's a good one to know about: automatic citizenship for a child, where all these requirements are met, that they are under the age of 18, they have a green card, and they live with at least one U.S. citizen parent that has legal and physical custody, and then that parent is a citizen. If all these things are met before the age of 18, and this only, I believe, came out in 2001, so you have to look at the year in which of it this the conditions were met, then they are automatically become a citizen. Well, do you get a little piece of paper that just flies into your hands? No, you don't. So you have to either one of two things. You can apply for an N-600. It's a certificate of citizenship, sort of like your American birth certificate, I guess you could say. Or you can apply for your passport. Many times we said, go apply for your passport because that you can do something with it. It's probably faster and it's cheaper and you can actually travel with it. But because passports can expire, in the last few years, I've started to tell people do both. And if you go get this, and if you have the N-600, then it'll make the passport application faster. But the N-600 is a bit costly and could take some time. So I'm just saying now do both because the N-600, the natural certificate of naturalization, citizenship does not have an expiration date. And so that is the reason why I highly suggest that one. So they've also been screening on the in naturalization application for people who might be citizens and don't know it. And so they ask a few questions because they find out if the individual did have status as a citizen, then they don't want them to apply for. I actually had a client one time get, he came to me after, but he applied for his naturalization and he got denied because they said, you're a citizen. And I was
Right.
like, yeah, it is crazy. But then he had problem proving it. So that's why he had to hire me. Anyway. But the biggest point here is that they want to make sure that the children are not wrongfully taken from the habitual residence. And I think that this is not my expertise, but I think this is more of a family law space, but this is where we could collide a bit. But I think we might be in a space where this might be coming up potentially. If some parents, maybe the non-citizen parent, might be getting deported potentially, or it has to go live abroad for a little while. I hope this isn't going to be more prevalent, but I think just keep this in mind. This is another one of the other Hague conventions I was mentioning about, and in considerations with custody and those battles and things like that. So let's move over to special immigrant juvenile status. So this is where you need the family and the immigration to come together. So if you have a child who's under 18 in Texas, but it could be under 21 in some states. So this is where the definition of a child in the state court for SAPSR or whatever the state court order is called in that state. The state court order needs to be done by the required amount of time, the age. So in Texas, I'll use that as example. It's 18. So and then the order has to specifically say that one or both of the parents abandoned, abused, or neglected the child, and it's not in the child's best interest to return to the home country. The child is unmarried because, by definition of immigration, a child cannot be married. And if you do not do the family court before they turn 18, then you in Texas, but there isn't a later date in some other states, then you cannot proceed with this. When I have tried to do this by on the family side, judges were questioning why I need that specific language. They were like trying to use other words. But if you do not have the exact words you need, then USCIS will, year many years later, deny it. So this is where that is very specifically needed. I think that if you are a family lawyer who does these and you probably teamed up with an immigration attorney, this could be a really good, I don't know, it was just going to be silly and say marriage between the family and the immigration attorney. But that collaboration could be very key. But I will mention that some of the things I see here are that it's usually that the dad was the one that abandoned and neglected or abused, not always. And it's usually the dad is not on the birth certificate. So then it gets really difficult, like when we're trying to put notices in like El Salvador, Honduras, or somewhere. And so those are the things I look for is are both of the parents on the birth certificate? Are those the correct birth parents? Because sometimes people put the darndest things on birth certificates, I've noticed in other countries. And then where is that individual and would they be willing to sign off? Or are we going to have to do some notices? Because that's really where my clients get a little overwhelmed and with the costs and the uncertainty of it all. But even with all of that, all of this is very dependent on the state court order, meaning that communication. And if it's poorly drafted, then it could be rejected by US many, many years later. And unfortunately, just recently, this is an area where USCIS is raising alarms about what they consider fraudulent filings. And so they noted some inconsistencies or what they considered fabricated family court orders and allegations of coaching minors. And so they've been putting some things on hold or pause, or I think there's going to be some more issues here. But we also are having other concerns that many cases were pending for so long for the visa to become available that we were able to close the court case in immigration court. But what's happening right now in the summer of 2025 is that the immigration court is recalendaring, is what we call it. They're sort of like opening up the case again, but we actually call it recalendaring, an administratively closed case. And so these ch children who are now a little bit older are being called in to go to court while they've been waiting for this visa to become available under the special immigrant juvenile status. And we're seeing cases where the children are having to pursue their asylum claims from something when they came here maybe 10 or I don't know, many years ago. And really don't really know much about their home country, but a lot of times we have to lean into their parents' asylum claim. Anyway, this is sort of a hot change that's happening, but it is an intersection between family and immigration and something that this is some changes that we're seeing right now. Under the Violence Against Women Act petitions, it allows spouses, children, and parents of abusive U.S. citizens or legal permanent residents to self-petition. What is self-petition? It means that you could petition on your own. You don't need someone else to petition for you, but you have to have that relationship. So it includes psychological, sexual, emotional, financial. But usually, whenever I filed any of them, there's a few instances of abuse, multiple ones, and it's usually quite unfortunate where it's this. It's usually in my cases I was applying under with the spouse, and the spouse is saying, "I'm going to call ICE on you," or "I'm." You're going to get deported, or I'm not going to let you have your phone, see your family, do this and that and stuff. So this has been a very protected area that I think US has been very generous to. Sometimes I had a client one time lived with her abusive spouse in hotels and barely had any proof that they lived together, but I was able to get that approved. I once had one that was an arranged marriage, and she was sort of tricked in the marriage and lived with her in-laws. But it was a bit hard to show the proof of all the relationship and everything, but we still were able to get that approved. But anyway, so you might not involve any police. They might not have proof of a police report or calling, but usually they'll go to a therapist and there might be some other evidence for affidavits and statements from friends and family who were witnesses. What's good about the VAWA is that you, even if you entered illegally, at least like let's say one time, you still could get your green card based off of this if you qualify for all the qualifications, all things being equal. But even if you're permanently barred between too many entries and exits, you might not be eligible for it. That's why you might need to move over to the U visa, the victim of a crime. This can include other family members, but for the most part, I've mostly filed just for spouses of U.S. citizens or legal permanent residents. And so that's why this relationship is important for family law. There's been some reported incidences of some attorneys or notarios or people using the doing some scamming on VAWA, unfortunately, and filing some fraudulent claims. So, there's been some recent news articles about this, so I think this is a little bit more prevalent than I'm really, it's very unfortunate because what's going to happen is that when this gets out more and more for whomever was filing these cases, it's going to question the VAWA cases that are out there. For example, there used to not be interviews for VAWA clients. And they would just do everything over paper, send us more evidence, tell us more, or just get approved. But for example, I'm going to an interview for a VAWA application green card, and they're starting to do that now because they're screening for fraudulent matters. So this is something that's happened, and I think it's going to make VAWA claims harder to get approved in the future, which is very unfortunate because those vulnerable people really need the leeway and discretion and just prosecutorial discretion to not be able, they might not have a lot of evidence for everything that happened. So the U visa, like I mentioned, could intersect with family with domestic violence. There's a list of qualifying crimes. So it's like aggravated assault, domestic violence, or like the two that I could think of the most likely to intersect with family. So it's not just any crime. There's a list of crimes, and you need to have a certification from a law enforcement, a qualifying agency. Once they agree to sign that signature and that form is good for 6 months, and then we have to file the rest of the package. But like I said, there's such a backlog of 10,000 visas a year that this came out around 2008 that people are waiting about 15 years right now. And unfortunately, under the Trump administration, they're saying that an individual, even in immigration court, cannot stay in the United States while they're waiting for the visa to become current, that 15 years, and that they would have to just leave the country. And then one day they still want to come back in. It is a very lenient visa because you can waive so many things like entries and exits or maybe making a false claim to citizenship. But anyway, this is where it intersects with family. The T visa, I mentioned this because there are sometimes people are victims of trafficking, but they might not realize it. It could be sexual or labor, but there is this sort of like a term that some attorneys have used. It's called like a Cinderella type of a T visa where the individual was basically like labor trafficked by their family or maybe perceived family or whatever type of family. And so that's the reason why I wanted to bring this one up in this context. There's less visas than the U, but this isn't as common as U. And right now, the wait time's about 2 years. But if a person's eligible for this is way better to apply for a T than the U because it's a lot faster.
15 years. That's just wild.
Yeah,
That's just
that.
wild. That who can wait 15 years for anything, you know? And especially
Well,
if it's humanitarian. But it's so actually, this is a good time to say, family lawyers, like if you want to feel bad for your friends and peers that are immigration attorneys, feel free to do that.
you give them permission.
Yeah, feel free because this is just a crazy time for immigration lawyers. It really is. It has not been easy these last year or two.
That's so true. So ultimately, the goal with both the U and the T is to be able to get legal permanent residency once the visa becomes available and after you wait a certain amount of time. That's the eventual goal there. Actually, if you want to talk about a long wait, the wait for a U.S. citizen petitioning for their Mexican brother or sister, you want to give me a number? You might know.
Can't be worse than 15.
Oh, it is. It's worse. It's 24. It's 24. They're working on March 2001 right now. So, yeah. I mean, some people do it, and some people like they're for if non-Mexicans, it's more like 12 years. And I mean, they're grateful that they stayed the course. If you look at the visa bulletin and you say no way, well, then you never took a chance. But it is very daunting to see that.
Yeah, I'd love to check
Well.
our immigration system, say yes or say no, do the due diligence. But when you get a 15, 16, 17-year backlog, that isn't, nobody feels good about that.
So back to temporary protected status. This can have a impact in terms of you could lose your work permit or might lose your deportation protection. A lot of times those long time, like the Honduran and El Salvadorian long time TPSs at recipients, a lot of them are have American kids, and they're as soon as their kid turns 21 and they have a legal entry, then they're having their kid petition for them, their child. But for some of the individuals that have TPS that got it more recently, like Venezuela or Nepal, or some of the other ones, the South Sudan and some other, they don't have, or Afghanistan or Ukraine, they weren't here as long, and so they might not have a qualifying relative to petition for them. But anyway, these are just sort of temporary statuses, I guess you could say. Some people would argue they're not statuses even. But that's one of the big trends under this administration is to sort of take away or discontinue a lot of the temporary statuses under paroles and U for U and temporary protected status. So we're having a lot of conversations with people once they know that their TPS is going to end. But honestly, they should have a conversation, a consultation regardless, because it looks like most of them are going to try to end most of them. But I don't want to scare people, but that's what it looks like, is to have a plan to transition to something else if possible. And like I was mentioning about birthright citizenship, in early January, I mean, in January, when Trump went into office, he had an executive order basically challenging birthright citizenship, which we had under, after the Civil War, to clarify the under the 14th Amendment, the children born in the U.S. soil are U.S. citizens, that jus soli. It's not in every country that happens, but that's one thing that makes the United States special. And in countries that don't have it, there's many times when children become stateless. And so anyway, Trump administration was trying to move forward to end birthright citizenship just merely through an executive act order action. Supreme Court made a ruling, but it really wasn't about the birthright citizenship per se. It was more about nationwide injunctions. And so it's still the conversation's still happening. And depending on when you watch this and what state you're in, it could have a different result. So this is a hot topic. I guess this is what I would just say is be aware of this, because like I mentioned earlier, a U.S. birth certificate might, in the future, might not be direct proof of citizenship. And so that is going to be mind-boggling, because we're going to have to then figure out what was the parent status, when were they born, what were they doing on that day, and did they pass the citizenship? And it's going to change the way a lot of things are processed as well. And there was an article, it was just talking, like, it's going to be a hot mess, honestly, because some states are going to have birthright citizenship and some won't, if this goes forward the way the administration is hoping. So that is a problem for another day that I'm not looking forward to. So naturalization, this is comes into play with family, where if an individual we receive their legal permanent their it is married, let's say they have their green card based off of based off marriage to a U.S. citizen. Well, then if they remain married and they've lived 3 years with that citizen, and this is down to like almost the day, like there's been problems where like if the citizen was one week off, 1 week on, or 1 month off, 1 week on, they will count that. So be aware of that. So 3 years. It's not just being married to a citizen 3 years, it's being married to them and living with them those 3 years that you could have qualified under the 3 year rule. Everybody else, it's a 5 year rule that a legal permanent resident is eligible, potentially eligible for naturalization, which is the ultimate goal a lot of people have, is to become a US citizen. So this is where if you get divorced before the 3 years, then you have to wait a little longer for the 5 year. This is where, or if like you can't become a citizen fast enough, so you can't pass on citizenship. Remember that one slide I mentioned about if the kid is a green card holder and the parent becomes a citizen, the kid's under 18. Well, if something like this happens where they get divorced before they can become a citizen, it could end up being that the kid has to just naturalize on their own in the future because they don't become an automatic citizen because by virtue of their parent. So this is, it's all interconnected. And different provisions of the law passing on citizenship really have to look to the year the child was born, whether the parents were married, whether it was the mom or dad. Or I mean, there's also surrogate and artificial. There's some other complications in that. And I didn't even put a slide on that, but like about citizenship. But so in court, there could be special immigrant juvenile, FAWA, U visas. There's lots of different forms of relief. Back to special immigrant juvenile. If there's misunderstandings of what is needs to be in the order, I once had a judge be like, "I don't want to put that in there. I don't want to." He was more or less saying, "I don't want to give this immigrant a green card." That's what I was getting from it, and I was like, "Wow!" But that's what happened. Some state courts, some localities in the U.S. are more friendly than others to immigrants, and so this can get very, particular. So there's lots of things to consider about the status of, I mean, a protective order could impact different petitions or the status of the children and family. And so like another thing is I've seen where there's domestic violence, usually whoever is calling the police, and then the police take away that the aggressor. Or sometimes it can get confused who's who. And then later on, that person is detained. And then the spouse is like trying to retract that call. But then it's too late. And so this is unfortunately what's going on right now, more than ever. And in fact, I think I'm hearing stories of people saying my neighbor's going to call, says if I don't do whatever, they're going to tell ICE about me. Or I wouldn't be surprised if there's more about with spouses potentially saying, actually, I have a story this week where someone's like, if you don't do this, I'm going to do that. And I'm like, oh my gosh,
But then you can't
really?
take that back once it's on record.
Yeah. And so those are the stories when I hear things like that, that I'm like, well, we're in pretty much Violence Against Women Act territory, or because that's a classic telltale example of that abuse. But I mean, along with other things, but that's usually just one sign of it. And if a parent's detained or deported, I mean, I think about these from the immigration perspective, but I don't know how the family lawyers are considering in this respect. But I was being asked this week, how do I get a detention facility to get a what was it, a guardian document signed by the parent? And I'm like, oh, well, first of all, get those things signed before you get detained, because then inside it's so much harder to bring in a notary to get the paper signed, or else you need to get the attorney involved and those types of things. That's another reason why to get a lot of these documents organized before you go, before anything more bad were to happen. I'm talking about like immigration needs to have a plan, estate planning, money, assets, access to funds. This is even an issue with a lot of times I feel like the males have access to things, and maybe the wife doesn't have access to things. She doesn't know where the accounts are. She's not on the account, and so I'm. It's not always the case, but I've seen this in some of the some immigrant communities. And so this is not the time to do that, because everyone needs to be able to access things. What if the breadwinner or the male person that maybe in this scenario is detained, and then the wife needs to go get money to pay an attorney? Well, and she can't. And that's what I had a case a few months ago where the wife had no clue where anything was, and it was the husband who had the passwords and everything, and he was the one, and it took about an extra week for her to go find everything. Anyway, don't get me started, but this is other things that can possibly happen. So have a plan, figure out who's going to be your guardian, figure out who's your power of attorney, have access to kid medication. Do they have asthma? Do they have seizures? Like, what are you going to do? talk, think it through, have a plan. What happens if the mommy and daddy don't come home at night? What, who are you going to call? What, you, when parents don't tell the kids like what's, and they're like age appropriate, what's going on, then I think they do a huge disservice if they try to act like everything's normal. I mean, I know we want to shield the children, but there's also talk about, do you get that dual citizenship for the child so they have passports? I think that's very case specific, but make sure at least they have their US passports. So if they need to travel to come see you, if you're detained or deported. So these are things that I'm thinking about. There's a lot of mixed status families in the United States, especially in some of these big immigrant states like New York and Texas and California. And so, you know, thinking, being smart, having a plan. I think another issue is just what's happening with the children. Are they being taken care of? Who's gonna, there's gonna be a lot of situations where they might not have someone, and that, you know, CPS or foster is going to have to step in. So I just reiterate as I'm closing, collaborate with Immigration Council. Know that there's things in constant flux. Even as an immigration attorney who's been practicing for a handful of years, if I don't pay attention and read the news every day, I will get behind because there's something that affects immigration every day. And then sometimes there'll be an announcement or there'll be a threat of something's going to happen or a leak, but it doesn't. But then sometimes there's these unofficial policies that are not announced. And so again, what Scott says, you have permission
Feel sorry for me now.
to very sorry for us. Yes, exactly. Don't all jump into immigration law right now all at once. But we do need good people in this field. So if you want to talk to me, I can help mentor you a little bit here. So just be aware of dates are important, documents are important, and really until an individual is a US citizen, immigration is a concern for them. And in fact, there was a memo recently about even talking about denaturalizing naturalized citizens, and that has put a lot of naturalized citizens on high alert, unfortunately. So don't give advice on immigration if you don't know immigration. Be aware of like mixed status families. ICE could be targeting insensitive locations like courts, schools, hospitals. Unfortunately, that was one of the first things that went out the window at the beginning of the administration. And there are lots of different resources. The American Immigration Lawyers Association is an organization I'm a part of. We have about 17,000 million members. I'm the secretary of the AILA Texas chapter, and we have 1,900 members between Texas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico. There's other great resources out there, and I appreciate your time. And if you have questions, you're more than welcome to reach out to me. On LinkedIn is probably a really good way, and then also by email. But my firm has a Facebook, X, Blue Sky, Instagram, TikTok, and we put videos in English and Spanish on a regular basis. We have a webinar in English and Spanish every week on really hot topics and things. So you can even just go to our YouTube Powers Law Group and see some other content we have out there and learn more about immigration. And then also we have a newsletter in English and Spanish that is a great resource because we summarize the key points of what's going on. So you don't have to be reading in the news every day. But you know, so if you just want to be on our newsletter and it has some information about that. But key points are don't assume. Team up with an experienced immigration attorney. Probably have a few you can refer to your clients. And it's very dynamic right now. And there's a lot of moving parts where I'm glad, grateful for you, Scott, for giving me this opportunity because I feel like it's a public service announcement to explain how interconnected these areas are and how detrimental it could be if there's a misstep on either lawyer's part or in this space, even the immigrant as well. So, thank you for the opportunity. And I just would love to, if anybody has any questions, they can always reach out to me and continue the conversation.
Yeah, look, listen, for our viewers and people watching the video, especially if you're a family lawyer or you practice family law, this session's really powerful and it can increase your ability to serve your clients in a bigger, better way. So if you'd like the deck, you can email me. My email is exactly what you see on the screen, scottberry@marketcrest.com. We can get you the deck. Ruby, share one last time how people can get you.
They could email me at ruby@rubypowerslaw.com, but they can find me on LinkedIn under Ruby Powers, and RubyPowers. And yeah, I'd love to stay in touch. And if you ever want to talk about law practice management, you can check out my podcast and book, Power Up Your Practice, and we can geek out about law practice management as well.
Thank you, Ruby. We appreciate it.